of different than some other forums that we've had. It's a time for sharing, for all of us to share stories and share feelings on, I guess, being a woman in today's society and things that have happened to us that we want to share with each other and with the rest of the community so they can kind of understand some of our feelings and some of our ideas. But mostly, it's a time to share with one another.
For the women that are coming in late, we'd ask that the women join the circle. Maybe we have a few empty seats here. Katie, if you'd like to come.
We had a nifty little thing to read here. No, that wasn't it. It's kind of a busy night. But some of the topics that we might want to discuss is possibly some of our fears, our physical fears of being a woman, some of the experience, some of the things we've experienced in the job place, maybe discrimination, or maybe some of the good things of being a woman and being in a career. Also, possibly sharing about being moms and being sisters and all those fun things too. But again, it's open for any type of discussion. Or not discussion, sharing. Thank you, Amelia. I'd like to start out by reading something really to help us kind of get centered. And his voice sang in each story. His life sprang from each death. Our sharing becomes one story of a simple, lonely search for life and hope and oneness. In a world which sobs for love, and we know that in our sharing, God's voice, with mighty breath, is saying, love each other and take each other's hand. For you are one, though many, and in each of you, I live. So listen to our story and share our pain and death. And oh, listen to our story and rise and live.
Well, I remember when my mother was pregnant with my sister, Cindy, who's 5 years younger than I am. I distinctly remember the day that she put my hand on her stomach and I could feel my sister moving. I didn't know it was my sister. But she said that I would soon have a brother or sister. And she bought me a doll that I named Tony. And we sent, I think it was to Penny's or Sears, and he arrived about the time my sister was born. And I remember going to the hospital that day with my father to pick my sister up. And at that time, they didn't let children go to the maternity ward. So I remember sitting on this long wooden bench and waiting for them to come down, and it seemed like it was forever. I waited and waited and waited, and they finally came. And I remember I had to hold her right when I was sitting on the bench. I wouldn't leave the hospital until they let me hold her. And then I also held her on the way home from the hospital. And I took care of Tony while my mother took care of my sister. And growing up, we fought a lot. We shared a room and we'd divide the room down the middle and dare each other to cross the line. And we'd physically fight. I would scratch her with my fingernails and she would kick me in the shins, and I still have the lumps in my legs from her kicking me. But after I went away to college, we started getting a lot closer. She would come and visit me and we'd go to the Goodwill and shop for clothes, and it was just really special when both her little boys were born.
Well, something along that line reminds me, Deb, when you talk about that. The other night when we had our discussion after around the book Women's Reality, and Verlon was listing advantages, I think, of, you know, being male or female. And childbirth went up under an advantage for women. And I had a little difficult time identifying with that. I mean, I got a sense that most women really do consider that a, you know, just a tremendous experience. But I guess in my generation, the experience of childbirth was so very different for most of us than it is now. But I still carry, you know, some real kind of sadness for myself about that. I'm really glad women now have a different experience, but I think back then, you know, husbands mostly just took their wives to the hospital, and when you arrived, that was the end of that relationship, and you went off into these strange directions, hoping for the best, not knowing a whole bunch. I think another thing, you know, about that whole issue, when I was pregnant the first time, I was teaching, and I could not teach beyond the third month of my pregnancy because I was pregnant. You know, all those things are, I mean, it's so different now, and I'm just really glad about that for women.
Perhaps in a somewhat humorous vein, at least I think it is now, along the same lines, I remember when my mother was pregnant with my youngest brother. I was 9 years old, and she must have been 6 months or more pregnant, and it was very obvious, and a neighbor saying to me, "When is your new little brother or sister going to arrive?" And I said, "A new little brother or sister?" I mean, such was the attitude to such things in my family and my parents' generation that I didn't even know told at that stage. And nor did I recognize the signs of pregnancy.
Well, I suppose since we're going, it seems to be going.
This is what women talk about first.
I come from a generation way, way before any of you. Since I'm the senior in the village, and Deb and I were talking today about survival of some of the past generations, and I hear today a lot of the hard times people are having in a different way, but I was the oldest girl of 7 in the family, and my youngest sister is 18 years younger than I am, and my mother had all her children at home. The doctors in those days would come to the home, and I also had 3 brothers, and so 10 children all survived and healthy, and we were all 10 still living up until 3 years ago when I was here. My youngest brother was killed in an accident, but that was rather an unusual thing to have so many of us still living and all blessed with good health. And of course we lived on a farm up in northern Minnesota. Poor farmers, and I think of solidarity meals now. We had lots of those when I was growing up, but we never went hungry.
Where in northern Minnesota did you live?
Oh, near near Warren, Minnesota. Mm-hmm. That's where I went to school, high school. Mm-hmm. And I then went on I didn't go on to college. I went to what they called, I think they called it normal training then. Mm-hmm. And I taught for about 5 years in one-room school, mm-hmm. where I walked to school and was my own janitor.
Mm-hmm. Also up near Warren area?
Mm-hmm.
Can't get much farther north than that.
No. But it was good, it was great being part of a large family.
Something that's kind of been on my mind the last few days. The other day, in our room, Kurt came barging in for something, and we ended up wrestling for about 20 minutes. And he kept saying, "Oh, you're so feisty. You're so wild," and making all these comments. And afterwards, I said to Jeanette something about how I had not behaved like that in a long time. And I started thinking about that. It felt very strange to me to be doing that after so many years. Because I've been 3 years at St. Olaf and haven't engaged in that sort of behavior. Being what it is. And along with that kind of fitting in came a memory that I did not even recall until about a week and a half ago. And after thinking about that, I thought, why am I always like that? I mean, I've always prided myself in being feisty and able to take on anyone. And I was the oldest in my family. I had two younger brothers, so they weren't much trouble till a couple years ago. Now they're both about a foot and a half taller than I am. But that kind of linked up with this memory I had of when I was in about eighth grade. And I had these two neighbors of ours. They were about probably 4 or 5 years older than I was, and they played football in high school and stuff. And we were all just friends. We'd hang around the neighborhood and talk. And one night they said, one of them's sister and I, the four of us were staying up, and they said, "Well, come here, we need to show you something." And I went over there, and I guess for lack of better words, although I did not think of it in these terms at the time, they tried to rape me. And my friend just stood there, and she stood there, and I was fighting and finally ended up screaming really, really loudly, and lights started flicking on, and it didn't actually happen, but it was very close. And afterwards I said to my friend, I said, "Why didn't you do anything?" And she looked at me and she said, "Well, they're football players, I'm just a girl." And I think subconsciously that has stuck with me for so long, and I never connected that, and I never thought about it until the other night when I started behaving in a very aggressive manner again. And that's just something that's been on my mind this week, about how things happen like that and imprint on us and we never ever remember them. I did not even remember that happening, and certainly never attributed it to any of my behaviors.
That loosely reminds me of a story that's both humorous and frightening at the same time. For me, I studied for a semester in Cambridge, England, and was taking a side trip with some friends to Ireland. And we went to Blarney to see the famous Blarney Castle and the Blarney Stone. And this castle was an amazing place, and what was even more amazing than the castle were the grounds around the castle. And I can't think of any word to describe it except mystical. I'd never experienced a feeling like that, and there was vegetation that grew in such a way that I'd never seen before. Lots of roots that wrapped around things, and I was just in awe, and it was such a spiritual place. It felt like a sacred place. And I was with, I traveled with five other people and was winding around in some of the paths, and many of them were overgrown, with two of those five, and we were taking some pictures, and my friends had run out of film, and I still had some pictures. And it was a beautiful, bright, sunny day, which is unusual in Ireland, at least especially that part. And I said, "Go on ahead, I'll catch you later." And I remember just being sort of in ecstasy and so happy that I started singing to myself in the woods there. And I took my last picture, and it was my parents' camera that made a real long buzzing noise when you came to the end of your film. So between that noise and my singing to myself, I guess I'd called attention to where I was in the forest. And I was walking along and heard some footsteps in back of me. And I turned around to see a stark naked man about, oh, I'd say probably 100 feet or so behind me. And I turned around and kind of chuckled. And those of you who have seen the film Room with a View, my first thought was that I sort of stumbled upon somebody who was in a swimming hole, and I kind of laughed it off and thought that was pretty funny. And I just kind of turned around and pretended like I hadn't seen anything, just would go on about my business. And this man called after me and said, I've taken off my clothes, now don't you want to take off yours? And at that point, it went from being what I thought was pretty funny to being very frightening. And I took off in a run, and he ran after me. And I had a pack on. It wasn't very heavy, but it was a pack nonetheless, which frightened me all the more that I would be slowed down. And I'd had some self-defense classes, and I'd had some, I'd read a lot of books. But what was even more frightening to me was at that point, my fear paralyzed me and I couldn't remember anything. I couldn't remember what I should do in a situation if I was being attacked. And suddenly this place that was felt mystical and sacred felt like it was closing in, and I didn't know where I was. And just this incredible fear came over me. And I couldn't remember how to get back to my friends. And I ran into another group of students. We were the only two people in this area, the only two groups. And I was so relieved to see these people. I didn't know who they were, and I'm starting to spew off this story that this naked man is chasing me, and they're looking at me like I'm wacko. And apparently as soon as I encountered these people, he dove off into the woods. And so then I sort of, my heart rate came back, and then I left and wasn't thinking clearly enough that I should stay with them or stay with people. And all of a sudden I was by myself again and began to panic that he was somewhere in the bushes and was going to come out again. And I came to a fork in the path and I couldn't remember which way to go. And I finally got out, and the rest of my friends are waiting for me by the castle, and they had found a stray dog. And this dog sensed from about 100 yards away that I was distressed and came running at me. And my friends thought that this dog was attacking me, but he was really sensing that I needed protection. And when I finally came to my friends and I was basically sort of hyperventilating and calmed down enough, after I calmed down my fear, I just had this incredible sense of anger, of realizing that it didn't matter how strong I felt about myself or confident that I felt about myself as a woman, that regardless, I was always at risk, and that's not something I can make go away. And we certainly are all at risk to some degree, but it would be a myth to not admit that women are more at risk. And here, I just remember feeling like here in the middle of this beautiful place, in broad daylight and sun, and in this sacred place, that could happen. And when I had to give a description to the Scottish police, he asked me for a description. And I said, well, it was white. That's, remember this image of stark whiteness against green, and that's about it. And when you think about it in the context of singing to yourself in the woods and having a naked man chase you, it sounds sort of funny. But digging deeper, it was easily the most frightening experience of my life.
Yeah, physical safety is kind of a big one, and it's really scary to have to think, now that I'm out of high school and out of a somewhat safe environment and I started dating in college, it is really scary, you know, even going out with someone you don't know and all the fears that your mom has, you know, has told you and you've read so much about, date rape and I remember one date that I went on and I was just nervous the whole time, just sat next to the car door ready to jump out any moment because I didn't feel like I knew that person well enough, and it's really sad that I can't feel comfortable. That it takes a long time, a lot of researching backgrounds, especially in a college environment where you just can't go. My mom was the counselor at the high school, so I could basically go look at their record, see what kind of problems they had. But in college, it's a different thing, and you're going on your instinct, and I don't know. I think God kind of gave women instinct a little bit too, because some of the people that I was really worried about ended up being the people that you should worry about, that you later heard stories. It's really scary that you have to check out someone's background so much, and because there's so much frightened of that physical safety.
Well, 15 years ago, I had worked out in Yellowstone in the summer and was taking the train back and had stopped in Fargo to visit some friends, and they were going to be going out of town that weekend, and I said, oh, just drop me off at the train station, I'll be fine there, because it was about 6 o'clock and the train didn't leave till 10 or 11 o'clock, and my father and grandfather worked for the railroad, so I felt comfortable in a train depot and a lot of other people wouldn't. And I was pretty naive. Also, I'd only lived in Minneapolis 1 year at that time, and so I dropped my stuff out and decided I'd walk downtown. And I started walking downtown, and you have your hiking boots on, your jeans, you know, and an old t-shirt. And this car pulled up, and it was an older gentleman. He had a uniform on, probably like an Air Force uniform on, and you know, a fatherly image. And he said, could you tell me where such and such a place is? And, you know, trusting everybody, I said, oh, I'm new in town. I don't know anything. I'm waiting for the train. And he said, well, I'm new here too, and I don't know anybody. How about if I take you out to dinner and dancing? And I said, no thanks, that's okay. And he goes, well, I really would like to talk to somebody. I go, no, that's okay. I'm just going downtown, and I'm going to the train depot and waiting for the train. And I wasn't scared. I was just, you know, under control. So I said, well, I have to get gas and drop my stuff out at the hotel. Why don't you come? He said, no, I'm not going to do that. I said, I'm not getting in your car. I said, if you want to, you know, and he said, well, how about if I pulled over here? And I said, oh, okay. So he pulled it over and talked, and I said, you know, anyway, to make a long story short, he left, and I went downtown and picked up some stuff, went back to the train depot, and he came back a couple times and sure, you don't want to go get gas? And by that time, there was a man behind the counter there, and that was my dad. I wasn't afraid, and it didn't hit me till after I left him and started walking downtown. It's like, hey, what's going on there? You know, you just have to trust your instincts. And you just, your guardian angels really work overtime sometimes, and, maybe he wouldn't have done anything, but he came back and was talking, and by that time I had my seat planted in the bench and I wasn't going to move, but he was still trying to get me to go out of the depot there. And it's, you know, you just have to, things can happen, and sometimes it surprises you what you come up with, or your, like you said, your gut instinct, you know. And yeah, sure, go out dinner and dancing in these boots.
The image I had of just kind of disgust that this fellow was pursuing you like that, and I think of a time when I was little, and I don't think there was anything sexual or nasty going on, but I hated it anyway, and I could never explain to my parents that I disliked this thing. And my dad had business trips every February somewhere in the South, and I got to go along with them to this whatever resort. It was all the same group of people, so I got to know some really nice folks. And Mr. Lane always made a big fuss over me, and when there was a dinner dance, he always wanted to teach me to do the cha-cha or the rumba. I can't remember it. I can still remember his aftershave. It was overpowering. But he made so much fuss over me as a cute little girl, and we were such a spectacle on the dance floor, and I hated it. And my parents, I don't know how much I was exuding my hate of the situation, but they were kind of pushing me too. Oh, this is so cute, Mr. Lane's just being a nice man to you. And I just remember hating it and hope that that I don't push my kids into things like that, because I was totally overwhelmed. There was nothing I could do. I was so little and he was so big. I was thinking of another thing about being a woman in this society, and in various groups we've talked about some feelings that various women have had about the exclusivity of exclusive language and worship, and that has not been for me an real emotional response of exclusiveness, but I have felt that in academia. And I remember at St. Olaf, I entered college, I was so hungry to go to college, I was so ready, and I just took off and studied my tail off and loved every minute of it my first year. And then some things changed, and not that this is a very important thing in the whole scope of life, but my grade point went down at a real definite angle. And when I graduated, I didn't feel very good about myself. I felt not good about myself at all. And I remember, you know, thinking that I really screwed up. And then I read a study that said nationwide that was a common trend for women to disachieve, I don't know what the word was, but achieve less at the end of their college years than the beginning of the college years. This was the late 60s, early 70s. And that's when I felt my pain. And I identified that certainly I had great responsibility. I was the one that had gotten the grades, but the milieu around me was not encouraging me. It was quite a stifling time, and I hadn't thought of that for a long time, but I do remember how painful that was. And I didn't know how to make it different at that time.
I can remember being elected to church council, went into the door of the meeting. Oh, Jean, I'm so glad you're on council. Now we have somebody to bake for us every meeting.
Oh. What'd you say?
I had all I could do to turn and keep going in the room.
I thought you were going to say then you'd be the secretary of the group.
Mm-hmm. So. When I first graduated from Michigan State, I'd gotten my master's there and had been well involved in expunging. So I'd been a women's, I have a certificate in women's studies, and so had, you know, gone through all this. And went to the College of St. Thomas where my first job was, and they had a women's association, and I thought, oh, this is great, you know, I'll be able to get back into some of these things. And went to the meeting, and it was held in one night after, I don't know, in the evening sometime, and walked into the room, and all these, you know, various women there, none of who I really recognized at all, and they came over and said, well, how nice of you to, you know, come, what department does your husband teach in? And I said, he doesn't. I work here. And basically the room was filled with wives of faculty members. And their purpose was they did a lot of playing pinochle and doing craft kind of project things together. But there wasn't any of the kind of, I don't know, discussion questions or kind of challenging thoughts that I had sort of expected. And, I didn't go back.
I remember with great glee the day the envelope came in the mail addressed to David to join the Spouses Auxiliary of a Medical School.
He didn't go either.
I must say I had a little feeling about that when the mail came today. Wednesday, Carl had gotten a letter with an invitation to be named in Who's Who in Education, and today I got mine. Of course, those are such a scheme anyway, but it just kind of tickled me because I had just assumed, I mean, I had been a lowly teacher, he had been an administrator, of course I'd be passed over, but when that came today, and my name was on the computer list too.
My first newspaper job was out in Wahpeton, North Dakota, and I moved out there after living in Minneapolis. And I remember one interview I went on, or several were like this. I remember going to talk with this one man. I don't remember what it was for, but he said, whose wife are you? It was not, what is your name? Or I would go, you know, interview other people, and they would say, well, how many children do you have? And I would say, well, I don't have children. I'm not married. And then they would say, oh, I'm really sorry. Someday you'll find a nice man, you know, and then you'll have children. And so it's like, what do you say? And I also lived in this, it was a big old house, and there were four of us women that lived. I lived in the basement, and then there were teachers that lived on the other three floors. And I was really lonely after I got there, and I was afraid that nobody would ever come and visit me because it was way across the state. And one weekend, a couple of male friends came to visit from the Twin Cities. And after they left on Sunday, the teacher upstairs called me up to her apartment and starts lecturing me on who can and cannot be seen coming out of the house because there were four single women that lived there. And that the school board member, one of the school board members, lived across the street and he would watch out the kitchen window and then report back to administrators who was seen coming in and out. And they had me, you know, several people had me dating men I had never even met, and it was just really hard living there. But I often was thankful that I was a newspaper reporter rather than a teacher, because people expect newspaper reporters to be kind of wild, you know, go to bars and drink, and whereas if you're a teacher, you know, it's like, but I couldn't believe it. I was like 31 years old, you know. I was being lectured on who couldn't come and visit me.
After I left school, high school, I wasn't really at all sure which direction I was going in. Still not now, but anyway. I ended up deciding to do agriculture, really because I'd fallen in love with cows. And thought that I wanted to work with them. And hadn't really considered how difficult it would be being a woman working in a very male-dominated profession. I spent my first year, in order to get into college, you have to do a year practical, a year pre-college on a farm. And I did that in Wales on a small dairy farm living with a Welsh-speaking family, and really didn't encounter very much discrimination at all. I mean, they were very good, and that sort of gave me a lot of confidence that they were letting me do everything. And then went for my interview at the college that I was intending to go to. And he asked me two questions which just threw me. The first was that he assumed that because I was interested in cows, that I really wasn't interested in cows at all. What I wanted to do was to work with the calves. It's just automatically assumed that because you're a woman, that's what you're good at. You're good at bringing up the young stock. You're not necessarily good at working with the adult stock. And that was not my gift. So that sort of threw me. And then he made this is the vice principal of this interviewing. He made this statement that, I'm glad that you want to come to our college, and I can see that you're bright and that you're going to do well, and that's what we really like having women here for, is because bright women in the classes make the men work harder. And it was at that point that I began thinking, oh, okay, I'm not here because I'm going to make your college have a better record, because the men can work harder.
What was it like when you were there?
There was a lot of assumptions made. Women aren't good at machinery, and that was just a given.
Mm-hmm.
We were there to pass the tools that one of the guys changed the oil in for. We were automatically expected to do livestock, and particularly young stock tasks. And men were automatically expected to do the crops and the machinery stuff. And I think that was hard on both sexes. I mean, the guys who were really good at livestock had a hard time, and the women who were really interested in crops had a hard time.
My first year at Manolith, even though I looked the part, was not Lutheran or Norwegian or from the Midwest. And I felt sort of like a fish out of water when I first got there. And one of the things that was striking that thankfully changed over the years, and was not the case in my junior and senior year, but in my freshman year, discussion-oriented classes, women almost never spoke up. And I found myself time and time again being the only woman who was willing to speak up in a discussion class. And I remember going through sort of pains to sort of sit on myself to not speak up this time, to give somebody else the opportunity, and really being sensitive about group dynamics and not wanting to dominate that. And yet it not happening time and time again, and in particular in my freshman English class, I remember I was the only woman who would speak up, and there were about half a dozen men or so that were fairly vocal. And we were studying Yeats, and I really loved Yeats' poetry, but one of the poems that we studied was called A Prayer for My Daughter that he wrote. And one of the lines was something to the effect of, I think I don't know the line exactly, but what it said was that he was saying to his newly born daughter that it would be best and safest for her to not have opinions. And I remember bringing it up in class, you know, there's a lot that's really beautiful about this poem that he's writing for his daughter, but this particular line is pretty sexist. And I said it about in that tone, and I certainly wasn't on a soapbox or anything, but that was sort of the beginning of the end of, for me, in that class. I was earmarked as a raving woman's liver, and there were three men out of the six who spoke a lot, and I don't like to make stereotypes, but unfortunately in this case it rang true. They were on the football team and were very aggressive personalities and took every opportunity for the rest of the semester to make pot shots at me in class. And how demeaning that felt, and how luckily I had a wonderful teacher who would often bring up similar points to mine and was a real support to me. But the movie Yentl came out about that time, and a lot of people didn't like that movie because there was too much singing or whatever, but it really spoke to me, just the feeling of loving learning and thinking, especially after that experience, that how much easier it would have been if I'd been male. And how grateful I was that that changed by the end of my college years, for the most part. Not entirely, but for the most part.
Well, tonight is reminding me a little bit of some aspects of the 60s. And one aspect of the 60s for me that was more vivid was the Civil Rights Movement. And I was a part of the Civil Rights Movement in some ways, and in the North rather than in the South, but apparently I was very young and very naive in a lot of ways, not naive of the city, naive of what a civil rights movement was about. I just came to Chicago because I had a brother there, and he was involved with something called Operation Breadbasket with somebody named Jesse Jackson. And I thought I wanted to come find out what was going on. And at that time, as some of you know, this is when Dr. King came into Chicago. And so I asked my brother if I could work in Chicago for the summer. And he said, well, I can't find you any paying job, but maybe I'll find you a volunteer job, something I'm doing. So I ended up with what was called the Chicago Freedom Movement. And so I don't think I had been there really too long. And as I say, I was very young. And one of the leaders of the Civil Rights Movement called me in his office and told me that I would be sleeping with everybody in the movement by the end of the summer. I said, I'm not either. I mean, he was just telling me what it was going to be. And as I understand it, women that were in the Civil Rights Movement, that's generally what their role was expected to be. If you know the Civil Rights Movement, generally is a pretty it was male-dominated. And very macho, very, very macho. And in a lot of ways, and things that, and I really appreciate a lot of things that happened, and that were for civil rights, of course. But interpersonal relationships were very interesting, I might say, in the movement. And one of the things I appreciate of Alice Walker is that in her book, In Search of Her Mother's Gardens, I mean, she's a contemporary, and she was involved in the civil rights movement in the South and was married to a white lawyer. And she also attests, and will write about too, I mean, what supposedly was many times the really real role of women in the movement. And as I say, a lot of very, very good things happened. And out of the civil rights movement, of course, came the women's movement. But I think that's something that kind of needs to sometimes be brought up.
It reminded us of Stokely Carmichael's quote that women's position in the civil rights movement should be prone.
Oh, yes, well, that was right. One of the other leaders, another point, he was a very interesting person. He had an idea for integration, and which he was certainly espousing, especially to all the white women, that, you know, integration would happen when, of course, there would be a lot of mixed babies that he was going to help with. Part of him is really serious.
How are women treated in the business world? Two experiences come to mind. A very dear friend of ours, Jerry, was dying. And He knew he didn't have long to live with cancer. And he wanted his wife well provided for. And one thing he said was, I want you to have a very good car now. So I don't want to be with you. You go down and choose the car that you want. Then bring it home and I'll test and see if it's all right. But I'm not going down with you. I want you to do the bargaining. So Sandra went down and got the car and brought it home, and Jerry said fine, and she took it back and bought the car from a salesman that knew the family. When the title to the car came back, it was in Jerry's name. It was just what they didn't want because of taxes. He was not at the store, had nothing to do with it. The other experience is my daughter's. She was an accountant, was out job hunting, and went to this firm of five men and wanted a job, and they really didn't have any then. So she said, well, there is a secretary's job. Can I be the secretary? And they said, yes. So she became the secretary, and after a while they had an opening, and she became a CPA in the firm. But if she hadn't been willing to be a secretary, she never probably would have gotten into the firm. And I just often thought of the fellow that got a job a month after her, who just walked in, and he was a CPA. She became a CPA before he did. She had to go to the secretary's office.
That reminds me of when I was living in Wahpeton. I went to a clinic for a routine gynecological exam, and they were asking me all these questions, and they said, well, who's going to be responsible for your bill? Well, they asked me if I was married, and I said no. And I said, well, you're not supposed to ask those questions to start with. And like marital status and age and those types of things. And she said, well, we just like to know that information. So I decided, okay, I'm not going to argue with her. Then she said, well, who's responsible for your bill? And I said, well, I am. But then they wanted like my parents' name on the form. And I said, well, what do you want that for? And she said, well, in case there's some type of emergency, we need to have a name so we can notify them. So I said, okay. And a few weeks later, after my exam, my parents send me the bill that they had received. And they're saying, "What? Why did we get this bill?" So they sent the bill directly to my father. And like I said, I was probably 30, 31 years old at the time.
I had been a nurse about a year, and Carl and I had been married a month. I prided myself on being a professional, a leader, confident, so on. I was working one night and couldn't get a catheter in this man, and he had a really high temp and kept calling his surgeon and kept saying, keep trying to put this catheter in and keep doing this and that. So I kept trying these things and it didn't work, and had the nursing supervisor in the room. She was a kind of stereotypical nursing supervisor of 7 years ago, out yellowed uniforms and cat-eyed glasses and greasy hair. And she was very nervous, and she'd just hover over me at the phone while I'd call him. And finally, after much trouble, he decided to come in and get this catheter in himself, which was not a gentle task at all. It had to be inserted with this wire, and it was very painful for the man. And I, of course, being the person I was concerned about the man's response to all of this and his pain. And And this man, the surgeon, said, empty this bag, tell me how much urine is in there. So I went and got the cylinder and into the container down hanging on the edge of the bed to empty it. And the bag was defective, and the spout that you empty out of wouldn't open. So I sat there trying to manipulate it, and it didn't work. I'd see my nursing supervisor with a pen. Her foot was tapping, I was sweating. It was horrible. And he said, "What's the matter there, girly? Don't you know how to work a catheter bag?" And I just shivered at the name, because I'd been called that name by so many physicians, girly, cutie, little girl, so on. And my charge nurse stood straight up and she said, "Why, Dr. Kong, this is Dr. Fahrenwald's daughter-in-law." And immediately he could you tell me how much urine is in there, please, just approximately. Then, from then on, he never called me a name. But it was just because of the name that I had on my name tag. It wasn't because he respected who I was. And that was my experience, working in an institution where my father-in-law was the director of an emergency department. My respect was conditional on my performance.
It's really interesting. We've talked about it a few times. I've talked with other women here, talking about the fear of physical abuse or things in the outside world. And here we don't have that. We don't have those worries. There's no reason to be concerned. And yet, this is true for myself, and I've talked to others as well. The other night I was in Narnia playing the piano and stuff, and I had to walk from Narnia to Lodge 6 about 3 o'clock in the morning. And there's always a slight chance that you might run into an animal, but there's not really any problems. And walking outside, my stomach just gets tight, and I find myself starting at every little noise and looking around, and just, it's like I feel like I've got to be watching behind me all the time. And I find that so disturbing, that here where my mind tells me and I know that I'm safe, I still have that ingrained in me that I always have to be watching over my shoulder. It infuriates me. It makes me want to go walk up and down the village in the middle of the night until I'm convinced that I'm going to be safe. But that just really amazes me, because I've never been anywhere that I felt safe. And I just assumed once I was here I would feel that. And although my head knows it, I still don't feel that.
I feel that too, to an extent, just an anger at the fact that I can't go wherever I want, whenever I want, because there may be some man there who wants to do me harm. And I do feel, coming from Washington, here is a great relief, but I know I'll sound pessimistic, but I feel very safe here, but I think it's naive to assume that we're totally safe here. I don't want to think that anyone here would do harm, but there's 70 people here. I, in the last year and a half, have regained memories of violence that was done to me as a child, and really has explained to me a lot of the reasons for my feelings towards men. I've always been sort of intimidated of men, pretty suspicious. I have a real strong intuition, and at points in my life it would go off, and I would know that, like Jeanette was saying, maybe somebody wasn't safe to be around. And I just have a whole lot of anger about what was done to me, and also just wondering, what is it about men? Why do they want to do this violence to us? It almost seems like a big cosmic joke to me that here we are, men and women, and not only are we very different, we have these different makeups and seem to want different things, but then men seem so bent on hurting women, doing violence to them. Since getting, you know, having my memories, I've done a lot of reading, talked to a lot of people, and it's really amazing the extent to which women are allowed to be beaten, killed, mutilated, raped, and it's allowed to go on. I just don't understand. To me, it's like a national shame. The figures are astounding. You know, by the time women are 18, a third of them have been raped or sexually abused. That's not including regular physical abuse. That's just sexual abuse. I don't understand why we allow it to happen. I don't understand why the government doesn't do something. I don't understand why men do it.
Yeah, I've been thinking about that a lot too, and like you said, this is a safer place for women, and that's been a real relief to me to be here and not always to have to worry about who might be lurking somewhere. And I too have a lot of anger about that. And I don't really know what to do with all that anger, you know, with the numbers, the statistics, and my friends who've been raped or victims of incest, or the type of reporter I am. I write a lot about those types of things, and it just feels really overwhelming to me, and I don't really know, you know, I'm not looking forward to going back out and having to think about those things. And I heard that women need more sleep than men do because that's always on their mind or in the back of their minds, or it's something that they always have to deal with. And I wrote this poem that kind of talks about some of these things. Imagine a world where children can walk alone clear across town to visit a friend, or accept candy and smiles from strangers without parents fearing they will end up in a dumpster. Imagine a world where young women don't have to check the back seats of their cars after night classes, and old women can throw away the bars on their windows and deadbolts on their doors and sit on their stoops at midnight feeling the soft rain on their gray heads. Imagine a world where mothers in apartment buildings can run down the basement to throw in a load of wash without wondering who might be lurking in the stairwell. Imagine a world where people, where women can hitchhike for the sheer adventure of it without chancing ending up dead in a ditch. Imagine a world where women can sleep with the windows wide open on stuffy summer nights without fearing they will wake up with a knife at their throat. Imagine.